This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Hosting family and friends for the holiday often means lots of mopping, sweeping, and scrubbing. But biologist Rob Dunn says you should be careful how you clean. The more you use pesticides and antimicrobials, the more you're helping the resistant species that live in your house, like German cockroaches and bedbugs. Rob has explored all the different species that live indoors in his new book, Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes, Camel Crickets and Honeybees, The Natural History of Where We Live. He's also a professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University. Rob, always a pleasure. Welcome back.
Oh, great to be on the show, Frank. Thanks.
What are some of the species that live in our homes? I mean, I know this is something that is now part of your research and it's been going on for a while, just to find out what's living under our noses.
Well, I mean, so a useful starting point is to realize that in homes, everything is alive. And so whether you recognize it or not, each surface, each room. And so the question then becomes, which life? And so we see all kinds of interesting things. And so there's a microbe that lives only in hot water heaters and then in places like hot springs in Yellowstone. There's a spider that runs around your kitchen. You probably don't notice it. It's teeny. And it spits a ball of venomous silk on fruit flies. And so it's a whole kind of wilderness.
When I catch him doing that, by the way, I send him in timeout. I don't always see it, but when I see it.
No, it's a little too much spitting, yeah.
No, but that's you say all that, and I can see people cringing now as you say that. A little spider spitting venomous balls on the, right? And they're going, ugh. But the fact is, it's been with us forever, and it hasn't killed us. So that's the very first thing you should take on board with your message. You're hearing about things you didn't know about. They've been there all along.
That's right. They've been there all along, and you're not going to get rid of all of them. And so the only choice available to you is which of these species would you like to live with?
Well, and how do we make that choice? Since, again, it's been kind of, we haven't thought about it because we haven't seen them. And the fact is they haven't hurt us. And in many cases, they may be helping us.
Yeah, so I think our default response has been the super effective cleaning solution response, where you buy the thing that kills 99% of what's around you. And that, I think, is the model we have as our default going to the future. We make our houses like space stations. The problem with that, as you might infer, is that 1%, that's an issue, right?
Yeah.
You're killing all the stuff that's easy to kill and leaving that 1% of really, really nasty stuff.
Which is then going to reproduce and be so happy that 99% of its competitors are gone, they're going to breed like microbes.
Exactly. And so there's a new Duke Medical Center that has had just this problem. Brand new shining facility. And in their water systems, they've cleaned out 99% of the microbes in the water and left this one non-tuberculous mycobacteria species that they now can't get rid of. Mm. And so in that building, they're having to bring in bottled water to do surgeries. Yeah.
So what do we do, though? We do want to clean, right? And maybe the idea is not to kill but remove some percentage of these things.
Yeah, so if you think about just bacteria, so there are at least millions, maybe trillions of species of bacteria on Earth. And about 50 of those species are harmful. And so what we want to do is, what are the simple ways we have of controlling those 50? And so we know vaccination, hand washing, some simple rules, like the rule about how long you keep food in your fridge. It's not a rule about keeping your food sterile. It's a rule about how long until that microbial community in that food gets to a point where, you shouldn't eat it anymore.
Yeah.
And so a set of simple public health rules that keep us really healthy. But then on the other end, moderation. Open your windows, eat some fermented foods, let your dog into the house, let it run around a little bit.
Well, you named a couple things there at the end I want to talk about. Fermented foods, for one, which gets to our dependence on microbes in our gut, for instance. We'll just start there, but they're everywhere. We need this biota to survive. That's part of it. So talk more about that and why, for instance, eating more fermented food would be good for us.
Well, so we have a whole, so if you think about your body, and we've talked about this before, your body really isn't in isolation. Everything that your body is a sort of connection to the rest of life. And so your gut doesn't work, doesn't digest properly unless it has microbes in it. Your skin doesn't really work unless it has a layer of microbes on it. Your immune system doesn't really work unless it's exposed to the right biodiversity of microbes in your daily world. but we've not built a system for thinking about how do we keep those things around. And so that's one of the pieces. But the other is that we have a bunch of historic traditional ways of favoring some of those species that we've not paid much attention to and yet can help. And so one of those is fermented foods. These are foods that are full of life. And when you eat those foods, that life goes into you and has the potential to help restore some of those microbes that we need.
You are what you eat. You've done a lot of work for this book in Raleigh. And what's interesting is that you're looking at what people are finding on the countertops, what people are finding around them every day, and you're finding species you didn't even know about. What are you learning from what other folks are telling you? What they're feeding into your system.
Yeah, it's amazing. So as we look around homes, we see that they're changing relative to what they used to be, but we're also seeing that most of the species in homes aren't being studied at all. Mm. We've kind of overlooked them, and part of it's because the people who study homes are mostly people who whose job it is to kill things. So how do you kill these pests? How do you kill these pathogens? And ecologists like me, we were told to go to the Galapagos, go to the rainforest, go to a deep sea vent and study what's there.
Yeah.
And it meant there wasn't anybody to look under your bed. And so when we look under beds, we find new species of insects, of spiders, of bacteria, of fungi. More species of fungi have been found in our studies in houses than there are named species of fungi in North America.
Wow. So, and this is just recently.
I mean, just in the last couple of years.
Wow. And you say also, by the way, the looking under your bed, we didn't need ecologists as long as we had J. Edgar Hoover. Now we need ecologists to actually start snooping around our houses.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
All right. Let's talk more about the indoor biome. It's evolving really fast. Not only are there lots of them and species we didn't know about, but the ones we know about are changing pretty fast.
It is. For multiple reasons. One is that the indoor biome has lots of food. Our bodies, our pets, our stored food. And so there are plenty of resources. But the other is, when we try to kill things, we speed up evolution. And so we imagine evolution as something that happens in the Galapagos. Instead, it's something that can happen right in your bedroom. I mean, every time you use an antibiotic, evolution is happening in response to the antibiotic. When you use a pesticide, if you don't kill every pest with that pesticide, evolution is happening in response to that pesticide. And it's if you can get away from the fact that it's happening where we live, some of those versions of evolution that are occurring around us are really, almost sublime. And so German cockroaches have actually evolved a distaste for certain sugars. The sugars that are in the most common baits that, you know, bait the German cockroach to their death, the German cockroaches now perceive those sugars as bitter, as distasteful. And so they go up to them and they want nothing to do with them. And that's evolved in the last, you know, decades. So here we bait our kids with really unhealthy cereal. We bait the roaches with the same thing, and they decline.
Well, and you have to think about what it's doing to us. I mean, even if we're keeping things out, if we are keeping things out of our system and being too pure about not ever getting a virus and not ever catching a cold, that can have an impact on your immune system and on your internal biota. So, you know, it's nice not to get the flu, but on the other hand, what are you leaving yourself open for? If the flu isn't there, who takes advantage of that?
Yeah, so we need exposures to a diversity of kinds of microbes. When we think about what those exposures should be, it's pretty tricky because you're dealing with some of the trickiest things in nature. Our immune systems are hard to understand. Microbes are hard to understand. The changing world is hard to understand. And so we're not going to fully understand it anytime in the near future. But we have hints. And so recently there was a study that compared houses of Amish families and Hutterite families in terms of their immune health and their microbes. And the Amish and Hutterites live very similar lives. They're both of Germanic descent, very similar genetically. But the Hutterites have really high incidence of allergy and asthma, and the Amish have almost no allergy and asthma problems. And so one of the things that is different is that the Hutterite farmers keep their animals and their farms relatively far from their homes, and their agriculture is industrialized, versus Amish farming, where the animals are very close to the house, the farm's close to the house. And so what a group at the University of Chicago did was to try and figure out, is there something in that dust in the Amish houses that's preventing allergy and asthma? And they found that the Amish houses have more kinds of microbes, different microbes. And if you give those microbes to mice that have asthma, it causes the symptoms of the asthma to go away.
So the people who live closest to the animals are the ones who have the fewest allergies.
Yeah, and you can repeat that in the lab.
Over and over.
So, you know, if you have asthma, go sniff around an Amish house.
Well, which gets to the point that you made earlier about leave your windows open when you can, right?
Yeah, this is something that, I mean, Florence Nightingale, as a student recently pointed out to me, suggested that for health, a hospital should leave their windows open. And we didn't know why, but recently a study showed that if you leave windows open in a hospital, it decreases the pathogens present in the rooms in the hospital compared to rooms that have the very best air cleaning system in the world.
Rule number one in the medical community, listen to the nurses. I will just tell you that, and then
we could just close there. I think that's a good,
that's
a good truism.
Listen to the nurses, and if you're a patient, listen politely to your doctor. But then when the doctor leaves, talk to the nurse to find out what's really going on. All right, that's not part of your book. Your book does talk about camel crickets, however. Fascinating creatures. I love them. Half of my staff was grossed out by them. They were like creeped out. I think they're cool.
Well, yeah, I think they're wonderful. And we discovered MJ Epps was working in the lab, and she was a postdoc at the time, and she discovered by working with the public that this giant species of Japanese camel cricket that people knew was in their house, were in their houses, but we didn't know were in houses. And so we published a paper on that, and we thought everyone would be so excited about it. New species in houses, moved from Japan. And instead, people like your staff said, oh, that's super gross. What good is it? And so we started to think, well, what good might this be? And so we teamed up with Stephanie Matthews and Amy Grundin and some other microbiologists to figure out what kind of useful microbes might a camel cricket have. And so we thought about it a little bit, and these crickets are really cave crickets that have moved into basements, and in caves they eat food that's super hard to digest. And so what if the camel cricket has microbes that break down things that we need to break down, like plastics or other waste products? And so we tested whether the camel cricket microbes could break down the waste product of the paper industry, which is this kind of like woody stuff in an alkaline bath. It's nasty, usually gets burned. And in the first individual cricket, we found four bacteria species that could do that.
And these things are probably, I don't know about this, but might this be a bacteria species that is unique to this cricket or perhaps, if not unique, found mostly only in this cricket?
So one of the species we found in the first camel cricket we searched appears to be new to science.
Wow.
And is so far known only from that individual camel cricket.
So the other thing that you can learn from something like this is that, first of all, taking that flyer, okay, what good is it? Well, let's find out what's unique about it and see how we can apply that to our problem. That's what you did. That's good scientific method. But the thing to take the step back from is something you said earlier. We don't know how the immune system works. It's pretty complicated. We don't know how all these biota and work together. It's because it's a complicated system and it's a matrix. So if we start our science from that point of humility, it would seem to me, we might get a little farther faster.
I think so. I mean, I think if there's one general rule of science, it's that we're always much more ignorant than we think we are.
Hey, what about shower heads? Now, there's something I should know a lot about because, you know, you kind of do it every day, and yet there's good bacteria and bad bacteria when it comes to shower heads.
Yeah, so in shower heads, if you unscrew that actual shower head and you look into the pipe, you'll see a little bit of gunk, and scientists call that gunk biofilm. And it's a kind of a apartment building that the bacteria poop for themselves. And then multiple species live together, and it's always there. But sometimes that biofilm has a kind of bacteria called non-tuberculous mycobacteria. To the average healthy person, they're not a problem typically. But if you're immunocompromised, which lots of people are, you have some unusual lung architecture, they can be very problematic. But we don't know a lot about what determines which shower heads they're in and which they're not in. And so we did a project where we sampled 600, 700 shower heads around the world to figure out what determines who has and doesn't have these bacteria. And so what we found was that in well water, they're typically relatively rare. And they're also relatively rare in European water systems where the water is not chlorinated. And so in Vienna, the water flows directly from the wild aquifer through your pipes into downtown Vienna.
Hmm.
But in water systems where you have a lot of residual chlorine, which is really common in the U.S., that chlorine appears to be killing most of the other bacteria but the non-tuberculous mycobacteria. And they're not really that tough as bacteria. But when all the competition is gone, they build their little apartment of feces and and they happily live out their lives. Yeah.
So is there any way, now this gets to, you know, the other side of this. Okay, we don't want to carpet bomb the home because some of this stuff is good for us, and also we may be promoting super bacteria. On the other hand, if we found something like this, is this something we should be looking for? Is there a way to test for it? And what would we do about it if we found it in our shower?
Yeah, so it's tricky, right? So the world is tricky to manage. And so in this case, we need the chlorination. Once we have a water system where the water that's going into it has the potential to have pathogens in it, then we need some sort of water treatment to get those pathogens out.
Right. The Vienna solution does not sound good to me.
Well, it's good. It's good if you know that the water is not polluted, if you know that it's an old enough aquifer that the pathogens have been controlled. But often, you know, we tend to poop in our water. It's just one of these human things we've not been able to get good about not doing. And so once you mess up the water system, then we need a way to control it. And so chlorination is super effective. Mm-hmm. It saves lives. But then we need a way of also balancing that. And what's the right amount that allows some other species to survive but keeps the fecal pathogens out?
Right. And again, it tends to be a bit of an arms race. If you came up with the solution for that particular strain of bacteria, you're likely to cause there's going to be an unintended consequence.
Yeah. I mean, I think we when we look to the future, we often envision a very technological future. And yet we're going to need to figure out how to manage biodiversity. We need to do it now. We need to do it in 100 years. If we're still around, we'll need to do it in 1,000 years. And so it's an ongoing process. Nature continues to change. And that's the one thing that we know is going to be constant.
And if you could focus, you've got a problem with the 50 strains of bacteria, the 50 variety species of bacteria that you mentioned out of the trillions, and that is something we'd like to deal with. If we can fix that, why not? 50 out of trillions. But maybe seeing those 50 as part of the trillions and not just one of 50 might be a better approach. That would be a more comprehensive approach. Is it practical?
Yeah, no, I think it is practical. And just to take a simple example, we know that hand washing with soap and water works. Why does it work? Well, it looks like what happens when you wash your hands with soap and water is that you're washing off the most recently arrived bacteria species. And the soap and water doesn't disrupt that layer of good bacteria on your skin. And so here's a really simple way. You go to the bathroom, you shake somebody's hand, maybe you get a fecal microbe. Well, if you wash your hands with soap and water, that most of the time gets rid of that microbe and leaves your good microbe, that shimmering, wondrous diversity, intact.
And it's not killing it. It's not a pesticide. It simply, you know, breaks down the oil on your hand, and the soap breaks down the oil, then all of it gets rinsed away. It just leaves.
That's right. And so I think that's a great model for how we think about these things.
Hey, let's talk about different species of cats and dogs. The fact that cats and dogs do bring microbes into the house. This is a good thing, a bad thing? And you found some interesting variety when you look at that.
Yeah, so if we look at all of the species in the house, we can actually tell whether there's a cat or a dog in the house, and even to some extent how many, just as a function of which microbes are in the house. Now, it's a very expensive party trick, right? Like, you give us a swab, we tell you whether you have a cat or a dog, and you tell us that you already knew. But what it's telling us is that the presence of the cat or a dog is having a big effect on what you're being exposed to. And with dogs, it looks like, especially in urban environments, that it's largely beneficial. The dogs are bringing in microbes from the soil. They're bringing in some microbes in their fur. And in context in which we're losing a lot of our beneficial microbes, that may be enough of a connection to nature to prevent us from getting some of these diseases, like allergy and asthma, that we're getting now because we're no longer exposed to the right species. Cats, on the other hand, They bring in some of those same things, but they also have crazy parasites like this parasite Toxoplasma gondii, a few years ago, it was revealed that when this parasite gets into mice and rats, it takes over their brains, releases the precursors of dopamine, and makes them no longer afraid of the smell of cat pee. It makes them more risky, and it does all of this because it can only have sex in a cat.
The microbe.
Yeah, this parasite.
So it goes into the mouse, takes over the brain, makes it love cats, and the cat eats the mouse, and now I can reproduce.
Yeah, and so for a long time, this was like look at the cool things that happen in nature, and no medical professional cared at all. And then it became clear that it can do the same thing in humans.
We're going to talk more about that. You got to read the book then. Rob Dunn, to find out more, the author of Never Home Alone, From Microbes to Millipedes. Rob, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks so much, Frank.
You can find links to our website at our website, stateofthings.org. He's also a professor in the Department of Applied Ecology at North Carolina State University. There's more of the State of Things just ahead. Stay tuned.